Okay, so this will be self-contained, and the reason is that what I talked about last Monday was the physics of cold, dense quark matter. Let me drop this for the moment. What I talked about last Wednesday was the physics of cold, dense quark matter. So for those of you who weren't here, this is the QCD phase diagram as a function of temperature on the vertical axis and baryon density on the horizontal axis. Actually, what I'm plotting is the chemical potential for baryon number. So nuclei live here with a chemical potential, which is roughly the nucleon mass minus a binding energy. So it's a little more than 900 MeV. And what we talked about last week was this stuff, cold, dense quark matter, how the pairing works. We talked about this CFL phase, which is the phase that we know will exist at high enough densities. We don't really know what lives here. It might be CFL all the way into the hadronic phase, but we don't know. And one interesting possibility, if it's not CFL, is this crystalline phase, which I talked about at the end on Monday. Now, the way that today's talk can be self-contained is that I'm going to go this direction instead of this. So for those of you who still have questions about this, save them for the very end, because I'm not going to talk about that today further. So what I wanted to talk about now is hot quark matter. What happens when you take a chunk of matter and heat it up?
One question, actually. There is a third axis. For CFL to exist, you have to introduce mu s as well.
This is last week's talk. As I already said last week, I was assuming weak equilibrium. So this is mu b upon assuming weak equilibrium, and that guarantees you that you have a certain.
Okay. Now you don't assume it because you're talking about heavy ion collisions. Therefore, mu s. Okay, fine.
I haven't even started yet. This is a slice through a larger dimensional space. It's, of course, many more dimensions than three. You have to think about all the quark masses, et cetera. But anyway, this is the relevant slice. This is the slice with which I can display the physics I want to talk about. If you like, it's sort of a bent slice through a parameter space. So I want to now talk about physics on the vertical axis and just off. So I'm going to start by talking about theory, but I want to, as soon as possible, get to talking about the experiments. And let me warn the experts in the audience that as soon as I start talking about heavy ion collisions, I'm not really the most expert person in the room. I'm going to try and give an orientation to the people who are less expert than I. In other words, the string theorists, the astrophysicists, and the condensed matter physicists in the room. If the experts have questions which they think will clarify what I'm saying for the non-experts, please ask them. If the experts want to have technical discussions, we'll have lots of time for that. Not necessarily today, not necessarily right now. Also, I reserve the right, when non-experts ask questions, to point to the relevant expert and ask for help. So on the vertical axis, we actually know a lot more from theory than we do on the horizontal axis, because on the vertical axis, there's no problem for lattice gauge theory. So there have been a lot of lattice simulations on the vertical axis, and I want to show two things from the lattice. I think I'm allowed to use transparencies for experimental results, and I'm going to treat lattice as an experiment here. If you want to know why do we think that as a function of temperature, how's the focus here? Okay. That actually fixed the focus. So why do we think that as a function of temperature you go from a gas of hadrons to a quark-gluon plasma? Of course, there were pre-existing theoretical arguments, but as of today, the reason we're confident in this is the lattice calculations. Here are two, probably not the most current anymore. This is one way of seeing deconfinement on the lattice. It's the pedestrian way of looking at deconfinement. You just calculate the energy density divided by t to the fourth, which is a way of counting degrees of freedom. And for a pion gas, it's 3, which in these, the pi's and whatnot have been dropped. So for 3 is here. This is 3 degrees of freedom. And a quark-gluon plasma has many more than 3 degrees of freedom because there's 3 flavors. For the fermions, there's spin 1/2, 3 flavors, 3 colors. And then there's the gluons also, which are spin 1, and then there's 8 gluons. So that's a lot of degrees of freedom. And in fact, it's this many degrees of freedom. If you had a non-interacting gas of quarks and gluons, with a Stefan-Boltzmann law for non-interacting ideal quark-gluon plasma, that would be here. And what the lattice calculation shows is a continuous but rapid transition from a pion gas to something which clearly deserves to be called a quark-gluon plasma, even though it's also clearly not ideal. There are certainly interactions. You can think of this as a measure of the importance of the interactions. And in fact, there's been a lot of theoretical work and many talks at this program about various ways of understanding this difference analytically. Jörg Schroeder will give, there have been several talks already. The one remaining one that's coming is Jörg Schroeder will talk about the physics of this next week sometime. Okay, but at a qualitative level, important thing to take away from this is gas of hadrons, gas of quarks and gluons, sorry, plasma of quarks and gluons, not ideal, but clearly much more akin to an ideal quark-gluon plasma than an ideal pion gas. Transition is continuous, but occurs over a relatively narrow range of temperatures. And if you ask the lattice people, what is this, what is one in these units, the Bielefeld group whose calculation this is, say it's the critical temperature is 173 plus or minus 8. That plus or minus 8 is a statistical error bar only. Systematics, the biggest systematic uncertainty in the lattice calculations is that the quarks are still a little bit too heavy. So, I don't know, a reasonable estimate. I put on here 140 to 190. That's probably overly conservative. Maybe it's 150 to 180 or something like that.
Is that anyway, a real transition or just a...
It's a crossover. It's like ionization of a gas. It's like the ionization of a gas in that physics down here is qualitatively different than physics up here, but this transition is, as far as we can tell from the lattice, a crossover. I'll say more about that in just a second. Here is chiral symmetry restoration. This is the chiral condensate decreasing for two different values of the quark mass. Again, this is a continuous transition, but now I can say a little more, and maybe I should do that on the chalkboard.
Is there some profound reason why the quark doesn't start at zero temperature?
No, it's not a profound reason at all. There's a practical reason it's not profound. And the practical reason has to do with the fact that they're doing the calculation on a finite volume, and they don't actually have a very good description of the gas of hadrons at low temperatures, because at finite volume that gas starts to become, first of all, hadrons become are not that much smaller than the volume itself, and as you go to low temperatures the hadron gas becomes dilute. There's no way they can describe a hadron gas quantitatively, so you can't take this calculation down to zero temperature. But it's just practical. Okay, so I drew no line on this vertical axis because the best evidence from the lattice is that this transition is a crossover. But you'll see that what I've done here is to make this line represents a first order phase transition coming to an end. I want to explain what the nature of the theoretical arguments that suggest that the phase diagram looks like this. If you start with QCD with mu equals md equals 0 and ms equals infinity, then chiral symmetry breaking is described by this symmetry breaking pattern. And this is isomorphic to O4, breaking to O3. And the kinetic matter physicists in the room will recognize that if I had written O3 going to O2, that's a Heisenberg magnet. So this is the dynamics of QCD is more like an anti-ferromagnet because the dispersion relation is linear. But for static properties, anti and ferro doesn't matter. So this idealization, you expect a real second order transition where if I plotted psi bar psi as a function of temperature, it should do something like that with critical exponents that are calculable. Now, what happens when you make mu equals md not zero? So you add a small light quark mass as nature does for us. Then that in the magnet analogy is like turning on an explicit symmetry breaking term. It's an explicit magnetic field. So that makes this curve do this. So now I have a crossover. I have a crossover which in the chiral limit becomes second order. So that's what's happening here. This has been smoothed out to a crossover because of the explicit chiral symmetry breaking introduced by light quark masses. But now what if you do mu equals md equals ms equals 0? This is the opposite idealization. The strange quark mass in nature is neither heavy nor light. It's in between. And then the symmetry breaking pattern is SU3. This is not equivalent to O anything breaks to O anything else. But it's some matrix model whose critical properties can be analyzed. It's been calculated in the epsilon expansion, first, I think, by Pizarski and Wilczek in 1984. And it's been this matrix model has been simulated on the lattice since. And this turns out to have a first-order transition. So when I have mu equals md equals ms equals 0, I have a first-order phase transition. It turns out to be a fairly weak first-order phase transition on the scale of the plots that I showed you before. Sort of, it looks more like this. The first-order disk jump in the chiral order parameter is small. It's a weak fluctuation-induced first-order phase transition. Similarly, if I plotted that epsilon over t to the fourth for three light quarks, the phase transition is quite weak. The first-order phase transition is quite weak. It looks something like this. So,
does it have to be first-order? I mean, three dimensions, right?
Three dimensions. So the statement is that from the epsilon expansion, you see no signs of an infrared fixed point. It turns out that...
But we know of cases where that's...
Yeah.
True,
right, but then you do a lattice calculation and you actually see a first-order phase transition. Yeah. But the argument, that just to give you a flavor of it, it turns out that in the theory of this symmetry breaking, there are two different quartic coefficients, call them lambda 1 and lambda 2. There are two independent quartic couplings. And you find an infrared fixed point, which is on this axis, which is stable in this direction, but unstable in that. And so there's this is in the epsilon expansion. So the statement is that in the epsilon expansion, by various other theoretical means, there's no sign of a stable infrared fixed point. Then you do a lattice calculation, and that was historically the first argument. Then you do a lattice calculation, you find a first-order phase transition. Then you do a lattice calculation in QCD, not in the matrix model, but in QCD, you also find a first-order phase transition. So the statement is that if QCD had a lighter strange quark, had a strange quark that was lighter than it does, this phase diagram would look like this. Now you ask, what happens if I start with ms equals, light, and raise the mass of the strange quark? And the expectation is that as you do that, this first order line retreats back to some point in the plane here, and we know very little about where this point is. Its position is very sensitive to quark masses, as you can tell by the argument I just made. It has been seen in a variety of models, but as we discussed last week, until very recently, there are no lattice calculations out here. So we don't know for sure where this point is. It might be here, it might be here, it might be here, it might be there. You might push it all the way back down to here, actually. But this is something which we'd like to look for, both in lattice calculations and in experiments. And that will be one of the two themes of the talk, is how to look for this point.
Does it reach the axis at some finite ms?
Yes.
So
I'm taking lattice calculations at face value here. There are always caveats in lattice calculations because the quark masses in a lattice calculation are never quite light enough. The light quarks are never quite light enough. The volume is never quite infinite. The lattice spacing is never quite zero. But these calculations are getting better and better with time, and I'm giving you sort of I'm taking them at face value for the purposes of this talk. I'm not going to describe all the caveats. Okay, so what I've told you about this part of the phase diagram from theory so far, continuous crossover like ionization on the vertical axis becomes first order somewhere, second order point at the dividing line. Now, I just want to advertise, this is partly because Ove Philipson is one of my postdocs, I want to advertise that for the first time now, within the last year, lattice calculations have started to be done at a mu which is small compared to the temperature. This is an example from Philipson and de Fourcroy and Philipson. their calculation, they say, is valid for mu over t less than about 1, which means if you translate this into mu baryon, it's mu baryon less than 500 MeV at a temperature of 170. So in other words, here's 500, here's 170. Their calculation is valid to the left of a diagonal line, which is about like this. And to something we're going to get to in a minute, the chemical potential at RIC is about 45 MeV, much less than 500 MeV, certainly. So these methods, even though they're not, they don't solve the hard problem, but they solve the relevant problem for heavy ion physics. What Philipson and de Forcon have done is to do a calculation that is done at imaginary chemical potential, and then analytically continue. You basically calculate some susceptibility on a finite in a finite volume. It's a finite volume calculation, as you know, any lattice calculation is finite volume. That means the susceptibility is an analytic function of the chemical potential, and so you can continue the peak of the susceptibility from real imaginary mu to real mu. And the surprising thing is it actually works. The way you do it is as, so I can get rid of the transparency, let me just show you the result first, then I'll tell you. What you find is that this is the location of the peak of the susceptibility, and notice that it's almost flat. This is temperature 160, 170, 180. So it's hardly changing all the way out to mu of 500. And that now agrees with the work of other people, which I'm not going to talk about. So I think the thing you can take away from this is that the transitional, the location of the peak of the crossover, the place where things are changing the most rapidly, where susceptibilities peak, is quite flat here. They've measured this curvature. You can see this is their uncertainty in the TC. So this is the uncertainty in setting the scale on the vertical axis. And then these bars are their estimates of the error in the continuation. Now, how did they manage to get such a small error in an analytic continuation? The reason is nature was actually was kind. What you do is, so at a bunch of different values of mu imaginary, so mu is mu real plus I times mu imaginary, at a bunch of different values of mu imaginary, you measure a susceptibility as a function of temperature and locate the peak. So this is the peak of a susceptibility. And they did this actually for three different susceptibilities. One associated with the chiral condensate, one roughly speaking associated with the energy density, and one associated with the Polyakov loop. They all peak at the same place, same temperature. So this is the temperature of the peak of the susceptibility. And you find a curve which looks like this, with some points with error bars. And now all they do is they use the fact that this quantity is even in mu I. So let's call this Tc of mu I. This has to be equal to some constant C1 plus some constant, let's call this C0, C2 times mu I squared plus C4 times mu I to the fourth. They argue that it has to be even. And then they just do a fit to this Taylor expansion. And it turns out that in the fit, C4 is small. Their fit is extremely good with just a parabola, although they do fit C4. And then you didn't continue this Taylor expansion, which is trivial. You just flip the sign of this coefficient.
How far are they going in imaginary chemical potential on the scale of periodicity?
They go all the way out to mu b equals 500 is the point where you hit the periodicity. Basically, this for you and you alone, I don't want to do this for everybody else, this curve in imaginary mu actually looks like this. Okay? And this is a mu I of 500, and it's a parabola all the way out to here, and they actually have data points. They followed it out all the way out to here. These are not just reflections of the old data points. They did independent calculations out here. They can see the periodicity. And they fit it with the sense in which nature was lucky is that all the way out to here, the coefficient C4 is such that this is just good enough. Anyway, you can read the paper. That's the way they do it. And the nice thing about this is that by doing a finite, all this was done at one lattice volume, so this is early days on this. You need to do a finite size analysis.
And, do you know that's analytic in the complex mu plane? Is that?
You can prove that for a finite system. Not in the infinite volume limit, but for, at any finite volume, it's analytic. Okay. So, this is hard. But I wanted to give you a sense that there are beginning to be some lattice results. The methods of de Forcon and Phillips, in principle, you could actually discover this point. They haven't yet, and they're not close to actually doing it. But by doing a finite size scaling analysis and seeing how their TC scales with volume as you take the volume larger and larger, you can differentiate between crossover, first order, and second order. That's a hard task. But as a statement of principle, you could imagine using this method to find this point. But they're not close to doing that yet. So anyway, I wanted to give you a sense from theory, from pure theory, starting with a QCD Lagrangian and using the best lattice technology money can buy, we know a lot on the vertical axis. I only told you a tiny piece of what we know on the vertical axis. And we're beginning to know a few things out here. Okay. Now, heavy ion collisions. For those of you who have never seen this picture, you don't have to dim the lights for this. That's a heavy ion collision. And it's sort of awe-inspiring that our experimental colleagues can do precision physics in this environment. This is a real event. This is a picture of a single collision as this picture was taken by the star detector. The star detector is a big cylindrical TPC. There was a gold nucleus that came in from out of the board. Another came in from the room. Another came out of the board. They collided in the center. And they made on the order of 4,000 to 5,000 charged particles in this collision. And those are the tracks of, actually you don't see all 4,000 to 5,000, you see whatever went into the acceptance of the detector, which is a little bit less, but several thousand charged particles. This is a big detector, it's many meters in diameter, it's many meters long. This picture is projected onto a screen, so these tracks are actually separated in three-dimensional space. They can do physics in this environment. And that.
What's the color coding?
Does anyone know? I think it's curvature, so it's momentum. Does anyone know for sure? I think that's right. But in reality, the real answer is this is the PR picture, right? And so they put some color in so that it would get on the cover of things, and it has. In fact, but it's in the Kavli Institute for Theoretical Physics marketing volume. I was very pleased to see that. I take no credit. I don't know who decided to put it in there, but it's a very nice picture. Okay, so how should you think about a collision like that? You slam two nuclei together, and you get thousands of particles out. I want to try and orient people who are not used to thinking about something as messy and gross as that, how to even begin. So I want to first discuss the sequence of events. What happens during the first few Fermi in time in one of those collisions? Well, the first thing that happens is that the initial collision, which you can think of as, at least initially, as, well, there are many caveats to what I'm about to say, but you can think of it initially as a superposition of many proton-proton collisions. And actually, that's not true. But just think about it for a second in that way. There's some initial collision which releases, or dumps, or however you want to call it, releases lots of quarks and gluons into a small volume. Now, at this moment, I have nothing like equilibrium. I have at this first moment, it's certainly not equilibrated because those protons, quarks and gluons are all going this way, for example. Certainly a very non-equilibrium situation. But the hope is that because I've dumped so many of them into a small volume, they bump into each other. They scatter off each other. And then the question is, does this thermalize? And the thing I want to stress is that this is an experimental question, ultimately. This is the question of whether you thermalize is something which must be tested experimentally, must be answered experimentally. And if the answer is no, then my talk is over. There's just a second, yeah?
Do people have a better than order of magnitude estimate of what the volume is?
Well, the volume changes with time because, I'll come to you in a second. I mean, you have a very good estimate of what the transverse volume is. It's the size of a nucleus. The question is what the longitudinal volume is. And as the, you have two pancakes, think in the center mass frame. I have two Lorentz contracted pancakes coming in. Now they're starting to separate. As time progresses, they're separating more and more. The longitudinal volume available is increasing. So there's longitudinal expansion. So the volume is steadily increasing.
But that's under good theoretical control, the volume.
Yeah. I mean, the thing which is not under good theoretical control is when do you equilibrate? The later you equilibrate, the larger the volume you're in by that time, and the lower the temperature at which you equilibrate. So I would say, if you ask, what is the volume at a time 0.1 Fermi, that's a trivial question to answer. But that's not the interesting question, because why did I pick 0.1 Fermi? The hard question is, by what time is it equilibrated?
Is this really a plasma, in the sense that you have a lot of particles in your biosphere?
Yes. Yes. We can try and do the arithmetic in real time. Depends. So the volume might be pi times r squared. R is about 7 Fermis. Pi times 7 squared. Let's say I'm at a time of a half a Fermi, so the volume in the longitudinal direction is 1. So this is 3 times 50 is 150 Fermi cubed. And the number of particles is of order the number of final state particles, so 5,000. So I have 5,000 particles in 150 Fermi cubed. The Debye length at a temperature of 250 MeV is of order 1 Fermi. So that's 5,000 over 150 per Debye volume. So yes. But I don't get to talk in this language unless it equilibrates. And it's expanding rapidly. The question is, is there enough rescattering as it expands for it to equilibrate? And we're going to come to that in a second. But let me just say clearly, if the answer to this question is no, then I don't get to go on with my talk. Because what I'm going to do is assume that the answer is yes. And if the answer is yes, we'll come back to this in a second. If yes, then this hot quark gluon plasma expands further, cools, and follows a track on the phase diagram. So the point is that if there's no the way I'm structuring my talk is I want to ask, I'm going to pretend that what I'm interested in life is this diagram. And I want to know, how can I use the experiment to learn about this diagram? There are other ways to look at life. You might decide that even if there's no equilibration, you're still interested in these collisions. But I'm going to define myself as being interested in this phase diagram. And so if no, I can't use these experiments to answer any questions about the diagram. If yes, then I've collided two of these together. There's been some non-equilibrium process which has created a bunch of quarks and gluons which have rescattered, equilibrated, and landed here. Or maybe they've landed here. But I have no, unlike in a tokamak, I have no walls holding this plasma in. So this stuff expands and cools through the phase transition. And then the final stage is freeze out.
Just for clarity, your thermalization equilibration, you don't really have in mind everything should equilibrate, right? It's enough that just locally you have equilibrium.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, local, right. Because the thing is expanding.
So I think there's hopeless to assume.
No. That local. Yes. Because the thing is expanding. I mean, it certainly never comes to rest. So, okay.
Are you deliberately drawing it to go through the crossover region? Possible that it could do otherwise?
Yes, it's possible it could do otherwise. I'm deliberately drawing it in about this place in the phase diagram, but this point could be over here. I mean, I'm drawing this at mu's, which were chosen deliberately, and as I'll explain in a minute. But as I already explained, we're very uncertain about where this point is. Okay, so what's freeze-out? Freeze-out is the same thing it is in cosmology. It's the moment in time after which nothing happens. So you have this plasma of quarks and gluons, which expanded through that crossover, is now a gas of hadrons. And these hadrons, all the way along this line, there's lots of rescattering occurring. I have local equilibrium by a hypothesis at this minute. And then at this point, the system has become dilute enough that things don't bump into each other anymore. And after this time, you just have free streaming. You have free streaming pions, other hadrons, mostly pions, which fly out and make all those beautiful colored tracks in the detector. Okay. And so to orient you, why did I drew two tracks here? I want to ask the following question. Why build RIC? What does RIC is a new accelerator. It has 10 times the energy of anything before, any accelerator before it for these kinds of experiments. Why go to higher collision energy? What does that buy you? Well, the idea is that by going to higher collision energy, you're increasing the initial temperature. So the idea of building a bigger accelerator is to push this point up. Okay, that's the hope. We have to come back to testing this experimentally, but that's the hope. Okay? But let me just finish my sentence. It's very important to understand that when you go from, so this is my cartoon for CERN collisions, and this is my cartoon for RIC collisions. And it's very important to notice that I drew these two arrows ending at the same temperature. And that's important to realize. It's important to realize that freeze out, when you see all those thousands of particles, their time of last scattering, that's what freeze out means. At the time of last scattering, you had a gas of hadrons, and the temperature of freeze out is determined by the diluteness of the system. So it doesn't matter how hot you start, freeze out is down here somewhere. So the important thing to realize is that as you build a bigger accelerator, you don't increase the freeze out temperature. The hope is that you increase the initial temperature, but you don't increase the freeze out temperature. Yes?
For the purpose of this talk, I guess you're only interested in what happens between 3 and 4, but not between 1 and 2, is that right? Because there must
As I'm going to say in a minute, this was Dima's talk.
Oh, okay.
Dima gave a chalkboard talk about 6 weeks ago, which was about this physics. Which I'm going to give credit to Dima in a minute and then move on. But yes, for the purpose of this talk, I'm really interested in, if you like, 3.
So there's a different time scale for going from a few particles to thousands of particles, right? Which is right after
that's
1.
That's essentially the way the language which people like Dima use is that you have Foxbit, you have components in the wave function of the proton at small x. They talk about releasing the virtual partons. I don't know whether Dima likes that. Various people at Brookhaven use that language. I can't remember if I've ever heard Dima say it. And I'm thinking of that as time zero. It's non-equilibrium. This is the physics of proton-proton scattering. It's not the physics of a quark gluon plasma. It's the physics of scattering. Given the wave function of the proton, you collide two of them together. What's the entropy of the final state? Well, what's the multiplicity in the final state? That's something you can do and answer with PP collisions, and then ask how things change in gold-gold collisions. Okay. Now the other point: why did I move the point from the right to the left? It's sort of obvious that the hope is anyway that as you build a bigger accelerator, you go up in initial temperature. But it's also should also be obvious to you that you go left. And the argument is the following: mu baryon, what is it? It's roughly, it's not equal to, but it controls the number, the net number of baryons divided by the entropy, and the entropy is basically the number of pions. And as you slam these nuclei together at higher and higher energy, you make more and more pions. 5,000 pions, the net number of baryons is small compared to 5,000 pions, so this is a small, this is small. And so as you, whether you like it or not, as you go to higher initial temperatures, you're also moving left on this phase diagram. Notice, by the way, this means you're doing a better and better job of approximating cosmology, because the Big Bang came down the vertical axis like this. So as you go to higher and higher collision energies, you make more and more entropy. In cosmology, mu b is 10 to the minus 9. Well, this ratio is 10 to the minus 9. You'll never get to 10 to the minus 9, but you're getting closer and closer. Yes? LHC will be somewhere like that. Now, I notice I'm not putting a vertical scale up here, yeah. But yes, if when 7 or 8 years from now people do heavy ion collisions of the LHC, the point is that there's meaning in the relative location of these. If Rick is here, then LHC will be further up and further to the left. But we still have a big if to talk about. Okay, so now what I want to do is parse the signatures. So I want to talk about four classes of signatures, and I want to spend most time on number four, which means I'm going to try and do one, two, and three quickly. So I want to divide signatures in heavy ion collisions into four categories. The first one is multiplicity. And this was the subject of Dima's talk. Dima gave a chalkboard talk 6 weeks ago. Multiplicity is the first thing you measure. It's the easiest thing to measure. You just count tracks. I shouldn't have said just. You count tracks, which as you can see is a challenge already, but you count tracks. So there's been a lot of experimental work on multiplicity at RIC in the last year or so, and a lot of theoretical work also, which this is what Dima talked about. From my point of view, this is to some. And in fact, one of the lessons of the last little while is that it might be quite to a large extent, the multiplicity is just determined by the initial release of partons. It's not clear how good a statement this is, but the spirit of Dima's talk was that if you try to explain the observed multiplicity by assuming that it reflects initial state physics, you do very well at describing various features of the multiplicity, in particular how the multiplicity changes with centrality and with energy. So that was Dima's talk. I don't want to re-give it. From my point of view, even if it's not determined to a large extent, even if it's not determined completely by the initial state physics, it's determined by to some large extent by the initial state physics. And I've defined myself as not interested in initial state physics. I've defined myself as interested in what happens on this phase diagram. So let's move on. The second thing you want to do is to characterize the hadrons at freeze-out. So the second thing you do sort of chronologically in the history of a new accelerator is you learn as much as you can about physics here or here or here. And obviously this is not the reason why you build RIC, okay? We didn't build RIC to study a hadron gas. But if you want to do 3 and 4, which are coming, you better understand this first. So this is the sort of in the chronology of the subject, this is the next thing you do. And so what do? You look at spectra. This was multiplicity. Now you look at spectra. You look at ratios between particle species A and particle species B. You look at two particle correlations. And from sort of observable properties of those hadrons in the final state, what are you trying to get? Your goal is to get T freeze out, mu freeze out, the average expansion velocity at freeze out, and I've written these in a bad order. I should have. If you ask what have we been getting for these numbers, so at RIC, mu freeze out is actually very well measured by now. It's 45 MeV at 130 GeV collisions. Well, this doesn't matter. It's 45 MeV RIC has run at two energies, and they get a mu which is 45 MeV at one energy and 30 MeV at the higher energy. This comes from say, for example, the antiproton to proton ratio. And that's why I've drawn things, you know, 45 is a lot smaller than 900, so Rick is somewhere well over to the left here. To compare at the CERN lower energy collisions, CERN, this was around 250. So CERN, this is 45, this is 250. Okay? The freeze-out temperatures are comparable, and the expansion velocities are around 0.7 and 0.5 times the speed of light. So let me just say a few words about how you get these numbers. You find that many, many spectra are falling off exponentially. And exponential falloff cries out Boltzmann. And you then check what slope you get from those exponential falloffs, thinking maybe I'll get a common slope for everybody. And you discover that you don't. You find that the exponential fit for protons and for pions is quite different. Now, why is that? It's because the sort of T fitted, well, I'm not going to write a real equation. I'll put equals in quotes. But it comes from the temperature at freeze-out plus the expansion velocity. What you're measuring is a momentum, and you see that if everybody is expanding with a common expansion velocity of 0.7c, then 0.7c for protons is a much larger momentum because protons are heavier. So the temperature you get by fitting the slope should be very different for protons because for protons it will actually be dominated by the expansion velocity. For pions, it's a relatively even mixture of these two. And this is sort of a convolution. This is not a literally, you don't literally add. But so you get exponential, you make exponential fits. You find freeze-out temperatures, which are the same at these two energies, two colliders, expansion velocities, which are a little different. And the main thing that's happened is actually that you've moved to the left. Now, there are many, this sort of gives you one sense of, I think there are many, in particular from CERN, which has been analyzing data for a good many years now, there are many pieces of evidence that what you have here is an equilibrated hadron gas. The event-by-event fluctuations are Gaussian, as you would expect in thermal equilibrium. They have widths that are understandable. The slopes all work. There's all kinds of pieces of evidence here. At RIC, this is still in process, but I think, you know, everyone expects that by this point you really are on the phase diagram. But who cares, right? I mean, as I said, we didn't build RIC to explore hadron gas, but I do want to sort of, I want to give a sense of the parameters, and actually, this was probably one of the first hard numbers to come from RIC after the multiplicity. Okay. Now, what about number three? I said four categories. What's my number three? Number three is, we're sort of going to work our way upwards on the diagram. So two was physics of freeze-out. Three is signatures telling us about the transition. And the one that is motivated by the first part of my talk is the question of how can you look for signatures of that critical point. So this is one example of using heavy ion collisions to sort of study this region of the diagram. So signatures of the critical point. And I want to focus on number four, but let me just give you the flavor of this. The idea is that this is a second order point. So how do you see a second order point in the water steam diagram? You look for critical opalescence. What is critical opalescence? It's long wavelength fluctuations. So here also you should get long wavelength fluctuations as you pass by here. How do you see long wavelength fluctuations? Therein lies a tale, which I won't tell, but what you get is enhanced event-by-event fluctuations of certain well-specified observables and I'm being vague here because I don't want to give this talk, but there are certain observables which are expected to fluctuate because they reflect the long wavelength fluctuations of the order parameter. They have to do with the momentum of soft pions, certain well-specified observables, and the enhancement is by a predicted amount. So one of the stories in heavy ion physics, one of the storylines is event-by-event fluctuations. This is actually one of the last things you do as an experimentalist. It turns out that to analyze event-by-event fluctuations, you have to understand your detector extremely well, because you have to worry about things going into cracks and all that stuff which theorists don't know or care about. But to experimentalists, event-by-event fluctuations is one of the last things you do with a detector. A lot of things that average out in means, you have to worry about whether they're real physics or cracks. I mean, metaphorically speaking. And so this is actually something which really, well, there have been some discussions, but nothing real yet from Rick. There's been a lot of stuff coming, there's been a lot of analysis from the CERN experiments, and actually the final numbers for these fluctuations from CERN, the CERN program, when did the lead beam begin at CERN? Was it 94? So the first lead-lead collisions at CERN were in 1994. The final results on event-by-event fluctuations from CERN are due this July. So this is hard for the experimentalists. But so what you do is you vary the collision energy. That means you're varying mu. And then you look for these enhanced fluctuations. And the CERN folks have run at three different energies. So if you like, there are CERN collisions. I'm not going to decorate this diagram quite badly. But there are CERN collisions here, here, and here. I just did this optimistically. Okay. CERN has run at three energies. We'll be hearing about their analyses this summer. And if we're so lucky as that the diagram is like this, then they should see larger event-by-event fluctuations for these two energies than for this energy. Okay? And we'll find out this summer. Rick will do this analysis towards the left. If the critical point lies out here, it will never be found. You might say, well, why don't we do lower energy collisions? Let's just, CERN is lower than Rick, let's just go lower. The point is, if you do very low energy collisions, you end up here. You don't end up there, sort of. So heavy ion collisions explore a swath of the diagram like this. And if we're lucky, if this critical point lies within the regime explored, there's a way to find it. And we'll find out from the experimentalists perhaps as soon as this summer, although maybe that's optimistic. Okay, so that's number three. I just wanted to give you a sense of one example of how to use experiments to study this region. But again, this is also not why we built RIC. It's a nice piece of physics, but the real reason we built RIC, or the experimentalists built RIC, was number four. You want to have examples of signatures allowing you to measure properties up here. So allowing you to measure properties of a hot quark-gluon plasma. This, by the way, is not a yes-no question. It's, as you can see, there's a crossover here. There's no yes-no question. Have you made a quark-gluon plasma? That's not a good question. It's not, the nature of the subject is not seeking the answer to yes or no questions. The nature of the subject is...
That was also true about your question, does it thermalize?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, which we're coming to. So I'm going to switch to transparencies for the rest now, because I'm going to be showing data interspersed with my scribbles. So signatures that allow you to measure the properties of a quark-gluon plasma. This is the goal of the RIC experiments. It's not a yes-no question. OK, so I'm going to describe two examples. So the first example is important because this is a signature. The buzzword is elliptic flow. I'll explain what that means. This is a signature which indicates the extent of early equilibration. I told you there's millions of well, there's lots of indication that by the time of freeze out you've equilibrated. What's the evidence that you equilibrate early? This is it. This is the piece of evidence. And in terms of measuring a property of the quark gluon plasma, this is not as simple as a measurement of the pressure of the QGP. That's too oversimplified, but that's the core of the idea. So the idea is the following. You look at those collisions in which they didn't collide head on. So you have two of these guys. One came in from here, one came out from the board. They collided, and they collided like that. They did not collide head on. Obviously, you can't aim the little buggers. So you don't aim them to achieve this. You select after the fact. You have a data set, a set of a million collisions on tape. By looking at, well, one way of describing it is, by looking at how much crap went down the bean pipe this way and this way, you know how big a fraction of the nucleus sort of missed each other. And that allows you to have a measurement of the centrality, the impact parameter. OK, but anyway, so experimentalists are good at this part. They can come up with a data sample which consists of collisions which look like this. Now let's think what would happen if there were no rescattering. If this was the sum of lots of independent proton-proton collisions in this red almond here, then every individual PP collision results in decay particles which and products which are azimuthally symmetric. So if the description of a heavy ion collision is lots of PP collisions, no equilibration, no rescattering, just lots of PP collisions, nothing more, then you should expect the particles in the final state of this heavy ion collision to be uniformly distributed in azimuth. Is that logic clear? So even though there's an obvious spatial asymmetry here, if nothing happens after the initial PP collisions, in the final state, what you measure is the momentum of those particles coming out. You don't, by the way, that detector is meters in size. The size of this almond is 10 to the minus, a few times 10 to the minus 15 meters. So from the what you observe are momenta. You don't sort of measure positions. You measure momenta. Okay. So in contrast, if there is rescattering, then, so if we get rescattering equilibration, then we should be able to talk about this red stuff here as stuff. And just not lots of independent PP collisions, but stuff, a gas with pressure. And pressure means pressure gradients. And whoops, if it's stuff with pressure, you can do a hydrodynamic calculation. This is one from Uli. Is Uli in the room? Well, Uli was the expert I was hoping to point to when I ran into trouble on this, but he's not here. So this is the same picture. And the point is that if this is stuff with pressure, then there's a much bigger pressure gradient in this direction than there is in this direction. Pressure gradients generate velocities. So you will generate much more velocity this way and this way than you do this way and this way. And if you can sort of see that, the little arrows here are velocities. And what you're supposed to see in this sequence of snapshots is that initially it's asymmetric in position space, but those gradients generate asymmetries in momenta. So what happens is that as this thing expands, it circularizes. And as it circularizes, you get more momentum this way than this way. Okay. So how do you look for this experimentally? That was a theorist's picture. Here's an experimentalist picture. They have better graphics. This is that picture. This is that red almond, the almond-shaped overlap region. And then the idea is that at the end of the day, what you have is lots of particles going out into the detector. And if this story is correct, you should have an azimuthal asymmetry. You should have more particles going this way than that. V2 is defined as the mean value of cos times cosine of 2 phi. Phi is the azimuthal angle in momentum space. Just to set the normalization, if I tell you that V2 is 0.17, that means actually that I have twice as many particles going this way and this way as this way and this way. This is 1/6. It has to do with the means of cosines. Anyway, given the way they've normalized their variable, 0.17 means twice as many particles left and right as up and down. So what does the data show? Zero means isotropic. This is the data from, this data is from STAR. Phobos has data which agrees. The red points are data. This, by the way, is printed from the Kavli Institute for Theoretical Physics webpage, and was a transparency shown at the conference, the kickoff conference that we had here in April. Not shown. This was not the first place it was shown, but it was shown and discussed at length here. And what you see here is that, well, first of all, so the horizontal axis here is impact parameter or centrality. One means head-on collision. So for a head-on collision, there's no initial position asymmetry, position space asymmetry, and so no asymmetry in momentum. As you go to more peripheral collisions, so these are the collisions that look like the one I drew, which missed each other, which didn't hit head-on, and you see this is 0.06. Okay, so it's 6% V2. And now what are these open bars here? These open bars are the predictions of hydrodynamics. What does that mean? First of all, notice that the predictions agree with the data. And now I'm going to take a little jab at Uli here, who's not present. But I think the most important thing here is that hydro has never worked before. And Uli is a big practitioner of hydro, so that may not be the way he would describe the work of him and many others previously. But it's a true fact that hydrodynamic calculations, what does hydrodynamics mean? It means you're assuming you have a fluid which is local in local thermal equilibrium, mean free paths are zero. So hydrodynamic calculations are based on the assumption of local equilibration. Stick the word local in there. And this has never worked before. Hydro is sort of has always been thought of as a bound in that you're assuming instantaneous equilibration. And that doesn't make any sense. How can you assume instantaneous equilibration? So in the old days at CERN, when the data had a V2 which was half hydro, you said, well, okay, we're not really too worried about that. There's no way that hydro could possibly work because you can't have instantaneous equilibration. And at RIC, what happens is that you actually get reasonable agreement with hydro. And what does this agreement mean? It means that you have rescattering equilibration pressure, in other words, hydro beginning to apply early. Now, why early? Well, if you wait a while before you start rescattering, you have a bunch of PP collisions that almond, and then everybody free streams. That almond begins to circularize just from free streaming. So if you wait for a while before you sort of turn on rescattering, then you won't get as large a V2. And Uli has estimated that, at least in the context of his hydro models, hydro has to start working as early as 0.6 fermis in order to explain as large a V2 as that. This is something which has been discussed a lot at this program because it's a real challenge to theory to understand how equilibration could possibly occur so quickly.
To be clear, this is a measure of some degree of rescattering.
Yes.
A long way from true equilibration.
Sure. But this is, yeah, this is, yeah, but the, right, but this is, I would say that this is a measure of the degree of equilibration that matters. It's a measure of the fact that you can start calling this a fluid, and that's all I really care about.
This is just one observable.
This is just one observable.
Which cannot be explained by hydrodynamics, so I would not say hydrodynamics works.
Well, wait a minute. I mean, hydrodynamics is not supposed to explain everything, but I have. Right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Exactly. This is not about equilibration of quantum numbers. It's about equilibration of momenta. And just for fun to prod Dirk. This is from Phoenix. What Phoenix has done is to do hydrodynamics. It's hydrodynamic. This again was from our conference. It's hydrodynamic fits. These are these exponential spectra that I mentioned before for pi plus, pi minus, protons, no, k plus, k minus, protons, antiprotons. And it's, of course, way too fuzzy to see anything. But what you're supposed to see is that the curves roughly go through the data. So what Phoenix says is that out to 1 GeV, hydro is describing the single particle spectra for all these species. Yeah, different centrality bins. Not the two particle correlations, that's correct. One of the big mysteries is those two particle correlations. I agree. Okay. The PT dependence, I just want to flash this. This is how this V2 depends on the transverse momentum of the particles you're looking at. And I just want to show, well, first of all, hydro, by the way, agrees with these curves out to around 2 GeV. There's no hydro fit on this plot, but This is for relatively head-on. This is more peripheral. This is more peripheral still. And the amazing thing I want to show you is how big this is. If you have peripheral collisions, so non-head-on collisions, and you look at particles with momenta from 2 to 6 GeV, B2 is around 20%. And 20%, remember, 17% meant twice as many particles left-right as up-down. So it's a huge effect. This is not some small little thing. It's a huge effect. These collisions are very unsymmetric. And Hydro describes everything to the left of about here quite well. And nobody, I would say, has a good description of these data. This is one of the challenges to theory at present, is to understand how this... Basically, Hydro actually predicts that it rises forever, okay? But you don't expect Hydro to work. I mean, why should Hydro work for these for 4 GeV particles? Basically, what you expect, everyone expected that it would, there's a long story here, but everyone expects that sooner or later it should fall back, because when you go to high enough, you know, 10 GeV, 20 GeV, it really should be independent PP collisions.
So maybe it's a mixture of Hydro and independent PP all the way up.
This is the real tale of the hydrodynamic. You know, Hydro has spectra which fall exponentially with some temperature which is fit to the data. That temperature is of order 100 MeV. This is way, way, way out on the tail of the distribution. This is not understood.
If this were a conventional plasma with the kind of counter streaming and velocity space that I saw in the image, you can have
counter streaming.
Well, you said you have things skinny in different directions.
Well, yeah. It's not, you don't have two fluids flowing through each other, though. Everybody's expanding. It's an explosion.
Okay, so you don't think you have any instabilities that cause fluctuations that
didn't that's a very interesting question. I don't want to say that. I would say that's a question I've wondered about. I mean, if this early equilibration is right, you need some new mechanism to explain how it can equilibrate that quickly. So if naive estimates based on scattering cross-sections suggest that it takes longer. So it suggests that there's been recent work by Greg Carter. Is Greg in the room?
Yeah.
There you are. By Greg, who's going to talk on Thursday about one idea for how you might explain very rapid equilibration, which involves a very explosive initial state. It could be that, well, anyway. Something new is needed to explain how the thing equilibrates that quickly, if that result holds up. And maybe some hydrodynamic instability would be relevant. Dirk, do you know? You're probably more...
It's not hydrodynamic,
it's kinetic. It's the velocity space instability.
What kind of instability?
There are instabilities driven by heat flux, counter-streaming
effects.
Okay.
There's a well-known class of instabilities in plasma physics where if the momentum distribution is not isotropic, and
yeah,
in this case it's probably elongated, then there are some instabilities that could give some kind of filamentation kind of phenomenon.
Well,
could perhaps provide, I mean,
anyway, I mean, I doubt this has been explored fully. And I have nothing to say. Ramon, let me finish. I'm over time already, and I want to finish my last point. I'm still gonna insist that you wait, because I want to finish. So the last signature I want to talk about is energy loss. What does this mean? Think about a proton-proton collision in which you have, say, a quark from one proton, a quark from another, they scatter, and you make a 10 GeV pion. Okay? Now, bury this proton-proton collision in the middle of a gold-gold collision. So this 10 GeV, this hard quark, which in this story was going to become a 10 GeV pion, now has to fight its way out through a lot of crap. Ultimately, it will come out, but it will have lost energy. And as a result, because the cross-section for making hard partons falls rapidly as you go to harder and harder, higher and higher momentum, the fact that these guys lose energy on the way out translates into the statement that you expect fewer high PT pions in a gold-gold collision than in a superposition of PP. Now, the reason why this is an interesting signature is that if you talk about a high enough PT parton, and if the temperature of your red gunk here is high enough, then this is something which can be calculated from first principles. And many people, some of whom were here earlier in the program, have been working on doing the first principles calculations. I'm going to sort of cartoonize their results and just say that if you assume that this red stuff is a quark gluon plasma with a temperature of about 250 MeV, that's of course not really much, much bigger than TC. TC was 170, remember. But this is a reasonable estimate for Rec. So then you, in this regime, you can't really use their calculation quantitatively, but if you do anyway, you expect that the energy loss of a hard parton should be about 5 to 10 GeVs per Fermi of red gunk that it travels through. In contrast, if you're, instead of a quark gluon plasma, you're traveling through nuclear matter, cold nuclear matter, the EDX is about 1/10 that. This comes partly from their theory and partly from analysis of data. So, but I want to stress that, okay, first of all, I want to say that if you have an equilibrated QGP, you really know what DEDX is measuring. If you have an equilibrated QGP, DEDX is a measure of mu squared over lambda, where mu is an inverse Debye length, and lambda is a transport mean free path. But seeing DEDX does not tell you anything about equilibration. Seeing DEDX just tells you you plowed through a lot of gunk. It basically tells you, it tells you the number density of colored objects in the gunk. Okay? So you should not think of it as a measure of equilibration. If by some other means you think you have an equilibrated system, then you know what you're measuring in terms of parameters of the QGP. But by itself, the EDX doesn't tell you about equilibration. The other thing that's very important is that this energy loss phenomenon was looked for and not seen at CERN. So now the question of the last year and the subject, I would say, is has it been seen at RIC? And the evidence that it might have been seen is this data. There's other data, but I'm just going to show one plot. The black blobs are the number of pions with momenta. Now notice this only goes out to 3 GeV or 4 GeV. So that's not very high, but that's the best we have until this summer. And this is for peripheral collisions. So this is for grazing collisions where you don't make much red gunk because you just have a grazing collision. This is for head-on collisions, and the solid line, look only at the solid line in the data. The solid line is the Phoenix experiment's prediction of what you would get for a whole bunch of independent PP collisions. And you see that the solid line fits for grazing collisions, which is what you would expect because there's not much energy loss if you just have a grazing collision. And for head-on collisions, if you trust this black line, the data is below it by about a factor of 8 here.
And the energy loss is seems to be a 0.5 GeV per Fermi. It's less even the energy loss in cold matter.
Well, no, but wait. That's coming in a second. That's the average energy loss. That's the average energy loss. So if I stop there, I would be a charlatan because there are major reasons for caution. First of all, how dare I talk about hard physics at 4 GeV? While at the same time saying that hydro worked out to 2 GeV. If it's true that hydrodynamics describes things out to 2 GeV, 4 GeV is not yet hard. The good news here is that this summer, at the summer conference in the subject, which is coming at the end of July, we're expecting to hear data out to 10 GeV, and that will make people more comfortable. The second reason why you shouldn't yet declare that this energy loss has been discovered is that that solid black line is suspect. What you really want is to analyze PP collisions at the same energy in the same detectors. That's coming this summer. And even better, the best reference that you want is proton gold collisions, because then you'll be comparing energy loss through whatever you make in the heavy ion collision with energy loss in nuclear matter. Now, so these are the caveats. These are the reasons for caution. But the reasons for interest, this is an effect that's been seen by whatever this is, it's been seen by two experiments. Even though the reference is suspect, the data agree between two experiments. It was not seen at lower energies. And to answer Dima's question, if you try and fit that, do model fits to that data, then 0.25 GeV per Fermi is the average energy loss over the whole lifetime of the collision all the way out to freeze out. If you ask what energy loss do you need initially, according to these gentlemen, it's around 7 GeV per Fermi, which is in the reasonable ballpark. So this is, I want to leave you with this as something to watch for the future. And I want to end with sort of where is this subject going. This is an optimist's future, okay? So this is the future question mark. So maybe 3 years down the road, suppose you at your home institutions get an experimentalist, not a theorist, to give you a colloquium on the subject. What's the optimistic thing you could look forward to? Perhaps that experimentalist will show you V2 and say, this is telling us that we're on the phase diagram and is actually constraining the value of the pressure. I didn't talk about this, but those hydrofits work. It's not a tight constraint, but they work better with a quark gluon plasma equation of state than with an equation of state with no phase transition. Maybe this measurement of DEDX will become real as you analyze, understand the reference better and better. That will be telling you something about the initial energy density. Things we haven't talked about at all yet, if you emit photons early on, they never interact again. Photons and electrons, when they're produced, they never interact again. So that means that in principle, they can directly tell you about the early times. The difficulty, of course, is that a photon doesn't come with a little label saying, I was emitted early. You know, you get photons from the whole history. You get photons from the initial scatterings. You get photons during a collaboration. You get photons from the quark gluon plasma. You get photons from hadron interactions. So it's a hard game. But the optimistic hope is that photons and dileptons encode information about the initial temperature. And they might tell you directly or give you direct constraints on the initial temperature. The other good thing is that these rates at high enough temperature, again, are calculable from first principles. Larry Yaffe is one of those who has been doing that. There's no RIC data yet, so that's why I didn't focus on this subject. And the optimistic hope is that by constraining the pressure, the energy density, and the temperature, you can test theoretical predictions about P over T to the fourth and energy over T to the fourth, which are the characteristic, which are characteristic quantities that are very different in quark gluon plasma than in a hadron gap. Finally, there's been a lot of discussion of J-psi physics. Very roughly speaking, you expect that in the quark gluon plasma produced at RIC, if you make charm-anti-charm pairs, they can't bind to form a J-psi, and BB bar pairs can bind to form an upsilon. So one of the things to wait for from the RIC experiments down the road is a measure of J-psis and upsilons, testing this idea that CC bars are unconfined, BB bars can bind. And finally, by measuring fluctuations versus root S, whoops, maybe we'll get a handle on the location of this critical point. So that's the optimistic possible future. There are the pessimistic future. Well, I won't give you the pessimistic future. I'll just stop.
What's the Reynolds number of your flow? Is there some reason you're using a hydrodynamics picture versus a viscous liquid picture?
So now Dirk has done hydro calculations. Uli's not in the room, so I'm risking my risk. I would say that the reason is that it's easier.
No, but there's a dimensional estimate that tells you which is the right calculation.
It depends on the viscosity.
100 with energy losses
divided by 0.15.
What viscosity are you using?
Yeah, with that high energy loss, is that true?
The question is, what's the viscosity? Why should you have ideal hydrodynamics, which assumes that, which neglects effects of viscosity? Why do you assume that mean free paths are arbitrarily short, which is the assumption of ideal hydro? And I don't know where Kao got that number from.
But maybe with that energy loss, those high energy losses,
yeah,
that's a higher viscosity in a fluids picture. So I'm just wondering, isn't that getting to very low Reynolds numbers? Isn't this fluid flow in a pipe rather than a shock wave?
I think this is the same question as what I said. It's precisely the same question.
No. This is not the same question as.
Not the same question. The question, when you write down the momentum equation, do you put in the viscous term or not?
Let me first of all give you the operational answer, which is people would love to, but it's too hard. It's relativistic.
I doubt it's too hard.
Well, okay, Dirk should now defend. Dirk has written hydro papers. Why is it too hard?
I mean, relativistic viscous hydro. I mean, you first have to formulate that.
Yeah, that's fine. The question is, what's the right calculation?
The right calculation, I would say, is relativistic viscous hydro. But no one's done it.
Then why would you even talk about whether or not V2 agrees or disagrees with the hydro if you know it's the viscosity.
Okay, that's a different question. It's not the question whether you can use or not use this.
No, I think the operational answer to that is that people have done the calculation with ideal hydro, and that again sets a limit. If the mean free paths are long, okay, then that means slow equilibration. That means that you should not agree. Ideal hydro should be seen as an upper bound on V2, because if you get away from this limit of very short mean free paths, which is what ideal hydro is, then you'll have some free streaming first before the thing equilibrates, because the mean free path is long. Mean free paths are long, and then you'll get smaller V2.
But this V2, which these guys show, also depends on the initial conditions. Okay, so that is not just hydro. Okay.
Yes, that's right. I should say that they take an equation. They take the equation of state from the lattice. I mean, it does depend weakly on the equation of state.
You are kind of initial longitudinal flow, which is also an assumption.
That's correct.
You relax that, and you will get even more V2 than these guys show.
Uli and Edward love to say that hydro is a parameter-free model. And I think the right way of looking at it is it may be parameter-free, but it's assumption-rich.
It's not a model in a sense. I mean, it's an assumption about energy momentum conservation at zero mean free path. And everything else is initial condition.
Yeah.
Okay, so any initial condition gives you any final state. There's no physics content.
Good. And we this discussion, we've been having these sorts of discussions a lot in the program. The thing I wanted to convey, though, is that what you're saying is, why should I trust ideal hydro quantitatively? It's a good benchmark. It's a good benchmark against which to compare the data. And what the data is telling us is that you're getting a lot of rescattering early, more than anyone had expected, more than at the CERN collision. An experimentalist probably would have given this talk not showing V2 versus theory, but showing V2 at RIC versus V2 at CERN. And it's a factor of two larger, which means that significant rescattering is occurring earlier at RIC than at the lower energy collision. And that's a statement that, that's data versus data, not data versus theory. So that's more real. Ramona.
Yeah, I was thinking about this V2 and the volume. You were saying earlier that the volume is fairly well understood, but the volume, obviously, especially in the semi-assembled collisions, depends on the impact parameter.
Yes.
And you can't measure that all that precisely,
especially
when you're talking about big centrality bins.
Yes.
And so it's interesting that the V2 looks like hydro in the most peripheral collisions.
Well, it's a little below in the most peripheral collisions, as it has to be.
It should be, because...
Right.
The assumption isn't holding.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you don't expect hydro to work. If you imagine a grazing collision such that one proton in each, it was a grazing heavy ion collision, which is so grazing that it's just a PP collision.
Yeah.
That's not hydro. So hydro has to break down as you go to the very peripheral, and it does.
Yeah.
What's your take on the suggestion that much of the V2 signature can be coming from what you called stage one?
That was an interesting idea, which has now been falsified by the data, as we had long discussions here when Kirill Tuchin and Roger wasn't here. Alex Krosnitz was here. The predictions from that give a completely wrong PT dependence. So that was a nice try, but the data, but well, there's, it's a good data's a good thing, and it didn't work. But we can talk more about that privately. But
so this is a relatively, does this thing start much narrower along the beam direction?
Yes. I mean, it starts at time zero. It has width zero, because if by time zero, let's be in the center mass frame, which at RIC is the lab frame, then these are very, very thin pancakes. At time zero, they're on top of each other.
So the pressure also in that direction is larger too, by the same token, but I guess that doesn't enter V2, because you're just looking at
it. No, we're looking only at transverse. I was talking about transverse dynamics, entirely transverse dynamics. Longitudinally, as was mentioned, in these hydro calculations, what is assumed is ideal Bjorkane boost invariant hydrodynamic expansion. One of the things that Dirk has been doing is testing the effects of getting away from that. Do you want to comment?
No.
Okay.
Okay, thank you again.